Welcome to the Early Bird Book Club podcast. I'm Deanna Larson with Nashville Public Library. Today we're speaking with John Franklin, author of The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. The book is described as an examination of the relationship between humans and dogs and why it's the most important connection humans have with any animal. Franklin talks about the evolution of wolves, wolf dogs, to dogs, and the evolution of their brains and behavior. He argues that dogs aren't domesticated, and he posits a theory that dogs were actually created by women. I started our conversation by asking Franklin if his dogs, Charlie and Sam, inspired his work. I've tried to ask as many of our Early Bird Book Club member questions as possible, but we did run out of time. So if we didn't get to your question, please keep entering the contest and trying to win. We appreciate all of you reading the book and asking such stimulating questions. And so now on to the conversation with John Franklin.
Well, I wanted to know, John, because I really so enjoyed this book, as I said, and I wondered if living with Charlie then and then Sam inspired you to write the book, or what made you decide to take, because it's a huge project.
Oh, God, yes. It was an accidental project. Mm. I mean, I spent 10 years very specifically on it, and 5 years before that, kind of working up to it, and you would never accept an assignment like that. Mm. But it was just that I was introduced to the world of dogs and realized how many people had them and how much they meant to people, and then suddenly, I mean, I've always, if you look at the patterns of my reporting over the years, My specialty is in the things that are right in front of us and we don't see. And all these dogs, and, you know, yeah, we make, you know, we see them and we make fun of them and the president has to have a dog and all that sort of thing. But, hey, wait a minute, there are probably more dogs than there are people in the United States. And that's not a small thing. How did this happen? And I'm basically a biology writer. That's not by choice, but that's the way it worked. And so I cover brain evolution and things like that. And I was in Baltimore when all of it started. And I just started, I mean, I just had to ask myself, why are we feeding all these animals? And it's really not because they make us feel good when we come home. I mean, they do.
Yes.
But that's not a big enough reason, especially when you consider that during the Cultural Revolution in China and during World War II in Japan, they would shoot you if they caught you with a dog.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because dogs ate food that people could eat. See? Oh. And so millions of people in China hid their dogs. It was worth their life to save their dog.
Well, it kind of reminds you of Katrina. It's the same kind of idea.
Exactly. If you're not going to take my dog, I'm going to stay here and drown with her.
Yeah, you're right. It was very insightful of you to realize, you know, most of us just stop at, I love my animal. But you're right. That goes beyond, I love my animal, I enjoy having an animal around. There is something much deeper at work there.
That's right. And so once I realized that, I went looking for whatever it was. Fairly obvious to me that it had to do with evolution in the fairly recent past.
Mm.
And then there's, at one point, actually before this, a photograph came across my desk that was a skeleton. Well, the picture looked down into the grave. It was a skeleton of an old man reaching out to touch a skeleton of a puppy.
Oh, that is just, it's so touching.
Oh, it is, and it's just, and I kept it, and it haunted me. Then it turns out that 12,000 years ago, an awful lot of things happened. To make a very long story a little shorter, so that I don't want to mess up the punchline, where we have to have each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a romantic sort of thing. Mm-hmm. If a dog, just to give you an example, if a dog is on its own, a stray dog lives an average of 2 years.
Right.
But a dog in the possession of a reasonable human will live 12 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
A human without a dog will live 70, I forget what the number is, 76 years or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
and with the dog, they'll live 79. So there's actually, it actually affects the mortality and morbidity rates. That's the big clue,
mm-hmm.
is that we need each other. Now,
yeah.
Now, do we need 88-year-old men, that is when we're talking about, 10 or 15,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
You don't need very many of them because they can't take care of themselves.
Right.
And you don't need many old dogs either, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But the dog gave the human an edge.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, there were wild wolves, and we didn't train those wolves. You can't train a wild wolf. As a matter of fact, there have been people who have tried it, and I think one woman was killed by it,
mm-hmm.
by one. And they've tried to cross them with dogs. They can do it, but they're dangerous animals. So we evolved a long time ago in trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we, how did we handle our garbage and everything else we didn't want? We just dropped it and it disappeared to the trees. And so when we're now down on the ground, we're real pigs. If we don't want it, we just drop it.
Right.
These bands of humans were the forerunners of trailer trash,
mm-hmm.
which we all are.
Instinctually,
we just want garbage out of sight, and if we don't smell it, we don't worry about it, which I think is one of the reasons that it's so hard for the environmentalists to get us upset about this, because, it's not something we're built to worry about. But, wolves don't bark, but one of the things that I found out that was fairly fascinating, that wolf cubs do bark.
Huh.
And there's a process in evolution by which an animal retains childish characteristics.
Oh, yes, right.
Called neoteny. It's fairly apparent if you study it that's how the wolf turned into a dog. Basically, it turned into a puppy wolf. Then you've got a situation. As soon as the first wolf starts to bark,
mm-hmm.
and he's hanging around human beings, I don't mean right around them, because I don't think they mingle very much.
Yeah.
Because they were still damn dangerous animals.
Mm-hmm.
Their eyes aren't as good as ours, but their ears certainly are, and their nose is simply unsurpassed.
Yeah.
If you think of a band, maybe there are six or seven adult males, warriors,
mm-hmm.
that are charged with protecting a camp. They have to stand watches. As an ex-Navy man, I know what it means to stand a watch. And you get up at 11 o'clock and then you spend 4 hours and you don't out in the cold and wishing you were somewhere else and bored out of your mind. And finally it's over, but the next day you're not worth a damn. So having dogs made it unnecessary to stand watches.
Mm.
Now that adds a considerable amount of energy to those, to the people in the group.
Absolutely, because danger, right, in the early days, danger was to avoid that was an essential part of your survival.
That's right, and there were all kinds of animals out there trying to get you, and the nastiest one of which was your own kind.
Right.
The dog, they couldn't get by the dog, which meant they couldn't surprise you. They, you know, they could still overwhelm you, but they couldn't surprise you.
And are you saying that eventually, it seems like in the early days, that because you could not really necessarily bond, if you want to use that word, bond with a wolf or a wolf pack, you observed their behavior, and as a human, you worked with their natural senses. And when they picked their ears up or they started smelling the air, you observed that and then took heed of what they were doing, right? So that was the sort of relationship?
Yes, I like to think this is a lot more modern, but I really think it goes, you know, back 20,000 years. In the Dakotas, on the bluffs above the Missouri River, there are sort of outlooks. If you go to one and you stand there and you can see everything below you,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, forests of cottonwood and things like that, if you then will kick the ground under your feet, you'll see pieces of broken flint and, you know, an arrow that was half done and an arrowhead that was half done and, you know, and broken and they broke more than they got.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, well, they were no better than the rest of us. There are reports from the early pioneers that the Indians would sit there with their dogs. And they would do their work, not really think about anything else. The dog would watch the valley. The dog's eyes are not as good as a human's, but their eyes are better if they're better at detecting movement.
Yes.
So, you know, a deer or something move, and there's some sort of an incredible connection between the dog mm-hmm. and the man. I used to sit out in Oregon, and we had the back porch that a deck that sort of was about 12 feet up and looked out over this valley. Mm-hmm. And I would sit there, you know, worry about whatever it is humans worry about, probably long forgotten and not worth worrying about.
Right.
But anyway, I would sit there and think about what I was trying to do.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to write a book at the time and was not having a lot of luck.
Right.
And Sam would sit there by me when he saw something. I can't tell you what happened. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm suddenly awake, alert, and looking in the direction he's looking in. I think it's partly body. But whatever it is, it's very strong because I am not going to not look up.
I remember as being a first-time dog owner, because I can remember this, you get used to the patterns of your dog's behavior, the little things they do, but there's a certain body posture that a dog makes when there's danger or they smell or they see something really odd or they hear something odd. And even as a first-time dog owner, I can remember totally respecting that, just knowing instinctually, this dog has heard something weird, and I need to pay attention to this.
Yeah, might be nothing different than someone moved the trailer last night, but they see differences when, you know, if we don't leave the wheelbarrow where the wheelbarrow belongs, he gets very upset.
That's right. It's the pattern thing. They see
That's
things
right.
that are not of the pattern that they usually are.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the thing that fascinated me most is the world of the nose, about which we know almost nothing.
Nothing. Even human nose and the whole sense of, you know, smell.
That's right.
Yeah.
I went up to the Monell Chemical Senses Center and talked at great length to a scientist up there and looked at dissected noses and things like that. And for all practical purposes, we don't have a nose. And, you know, the dog sits there. He has control.
Mm-hmm.
His nose is compartmentalized.
Mm-hmm.
Compartmentalized. So he can trap a couple of molecules and sort of savor them. and figure out what they are. And they've got something else, too, that people don't usually notice. The nose has veins on both sides, you know, V-A-N-E-S,
mm-hmm.
like, and it can open and close and, you know, bring in air from over here and bring in air from over there. Watch a dog that's alert sometime and watch those wings mm-hmm. of the nose. And something else is, you know, he can see around, Sam can see around corners because he's smelling. That's one of the advantages of the smell world. And he could tell, a dog can tell, if out of sight, in the next valley, there's a herd of deer, you know, and there's a male, and there's two fawns, and there are three females, and one of the females is an estrus. I mean, this is just all, he just knows this.
Yeah, it's pretty miraculous, too, when you notice, you know, when they huff out, you know, that they're actually trying to get a better sort of grip on the scent, and they do various things to make sure that they're getting the full bouquet, or however you want to refer to it. And I always find that really interesting, too. Like you're saying, they have different approaches depending on the information that they're getting.
Uh-huh. And we go on overload. If you start smelling something, it won't be more than 5 or 10 minutes before you can't smell it anymore. When I was in the Navy, they were kind enough to give my family housing next to the Blue Plains sewage plant. We treat our troops great, and it was really putrid. It was notorious, and you know, after a week, we forgot it. But friends would come over and say, how in the hell can you live here?
And your dog friends probably would have said the same thing, right? It would have been overwhelming to them.
Well, the thing is that the dog, what they say is I forget the technical name they use for it, but basically you can't smell that smell anymore. It doesn't work with dogs that way. Dogs can smell that smell all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get smell exhaustion.
They don't have to sniff coffee beans in between the bouquet of one perfume or another, or one wine or another. Where did you go first to start looking into all these things?
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I started asking myself one of these questions, and I went to the library, and I had a good university library to go to, and I found out there wasn't anything in it. About, I mean, lots of books about dogs, dog breeds, how to train dogs. Probably how to cook dogs,
right.
but nothing about where dogs came from. And this is very unusual because there's a whole shelf about where goats came from, you know, and cows. And that's when it started hitting me,
mm-hmm.
and what made me decide to go after this, insofar as I did decide, was that, wait a minute, when the human being ignores something like this, or can't see it, that means that it has a great meaning to us and we can't look at it.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Okay, what did you think that that meant in the beginning, and did your idea about that change by the time you finished the book?
It deepened, and as a matter of fact, I think people call this a dog book, but I don't consider it about dogs. You know, the dog doesn't care. This is a book about people who can be selectively blind because they don't want to know that they, in fact, are part of a symbiosis.
Okay, and I wanted you to talk a little more about that, so this is a perfect time, because I don't know that I understand that exactly.
Well, because of the way Darwin went about it, and it's the obvious way, we think of evolution as consisting primarily of species dividing. But we know that sometimes you'll get two or three species that will combine, like on lichens and things like that. Mm. And then in the 60s, we started finding out, hey, wait a minute, the human body, well, in the cell, organelle, the mitochondria, that provides all of our energy, without which we, you've never seen anyone with a mitochondrial defect because they're dead in the womb. That and this is a separate creature, And at some point in the very, very distant past, one of these beasties got into another kind of beastie, and it was so more efficient at producing ATP, which is the gasoline we burn, that this cell that had it could outdo every other cell around it. And so pretty soon all of them had it. You know, there's evidence, I think good evidence, that when dogs first appeared, and how that happened is actually too long to tell the story here, but when they appeared simultaneously, apparently, all over the world. One of two things happened. Either everybody got the idea and you know, we're trading in dogs because the first dogs would have been precious. Or everybody basically made the same discovery at the same time, and there's some fairly good arguments about that.
Yeah.
Or several groups of people made the discovery, and they wiped all the others out. One of the animals that disappeared at the moment that we got the dog, Neanderthal, was gone.
So it was like the next stage or something. It was, right? Saying that right? Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just that there was nothing more deadly extreme than the combination of the dog and the man.
So, like, what you're saying is that possibly the dog ushered in a new era.
Well, it's funny. It's that was the time the Ice Age was ending, and things were getting kind of tough for meteorological reasons or climatological reasons that get pretty complicated. But all these animals in the north had been living on caribou. And so the caribou herds start diminishing. So now there's not enough to go around. So there's a question of who are going to get the caribou, who are going to own the caribou that are there. And what happened was it was the man with the dog.
Because the dog helped them hunt and kind of use hypersensitive?
No, because, I mean, dog have been helping them hunt for a long time.
Yeah.
But because the dog, the way behavior evolves is some piece of it is dropped or added. The wolf, before it attacks, the wolf pack will run around the herd and then cut one out. Herding dogs will run around the herd, but it won't. They won't go in and cut one out.
That's right.
And dogs are... wolves are not friendly to one another. They have their own family, and they will kill trespassers. And the dogs are the same way. So now there's no question whatsoever but what a full-grown wolf could kill a full-grown dog. But the problem is, from the predator's point of view, and people don't realize this, but if the predator gets hurt, then the predator has to be in perfect condition in order to live. So that's why predators are so specialized, and they don't, they almost never attack anything bigger than they are, let alone things smaller. I mean, when you stop and think about it, we use dogs and little dogs to treat cougars. Well, heck, that cougar could turn around and just, there'd be pieces of dog flying everywhere. But one of them would get in a critical bite. And it'd get infected. Predators are actually among the most cowardly of animals.
That's really interesting. Okay, so back to the caribou, though. Okay, so here, there's a lack of caribou, and then we're having this kind of changeover. So what was the crucial role of the wolf and then the dog in that?
Well, now you've got two groups. You got the dog, you got the wolf, and you got the wolf dog. The wolf dog won't attack those caribou, but will keep circling them, raise hell if it sees a wolf.
Oh, I see.
Or rather, smell a wolf.
I see. Okay, right. So we're starting to pull away from the wolf, and it's starting to align itself more with the human and what the human needs to do to survive.
The, That's right, because if the human doesn't survive, by this point, neither does the follower of wolf. Now, in the beginning, my suspicion is that the follower wolves mm-hmm. were wolves that were had been injured or were born with defects. Because why were they wandering, you know?
Yes.
And so they were a little different anyway.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, you know, people estimate, well, this critical junction at 12,000 years, those follower wolves may have been developing and changing for half a million years.
Right, and that there was just this sort of, they got to this intersection where they were a little seeking out a little bit more of human company. Maybe there was a little bit of something in those particular wolves, right? And then yeah. The humans started to cultivate, do you think, and then start to breed them?
Sure. I think that once they got tame enough, although tame is wrong, once they had become accustomed to seeing humans as part of the pack, and I think dogs were created by women because women do the cooking everywhere. So we decide, you know, I decide I'm going to feed my family a puppy for supper.
Uh-huh.
So I go out and I find myself some puppies, and you know there are two of them. There. And one of them growls and snaps at me, and the other one wags its tail and licks my hand. Which one am I going to brain?
Right.
They were also brought back to comfort ill people and amuse the children. That happens in Australia today with dingoes. And then when the dingo gets, when maturity comes, the dingo just vanishes.
So earlier, you know, when the dingo is young, it's able to be caught and kind of played with. But what you're saying is then when it gets to a certain age, it kind of instinctually knows it belongs somewhere else?
Yeah.
That's pretty fascinating.
And the your dog is apparently the dingo or something like that
mm-hmm.
in the sense that if the dog came from the wolf, which we know it did.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the genetics now. I mean, they're closer. A dog is closer to a wolf than genetically than I am to you, probably. They are really, really close over a very, very long period of time where you have this symbiotic relationship
mm-hmm.
developing, especially when you have the woman sort of handling it.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, men start to hunt with them. It's known that people hunted in the American Southwest. They hunted herds of mammoths with dogs, and they would run them over cliffs. But that was quite a bit afterwards. But 12,000 years ago, you had the first domesticated animal, if you want to say. It's domesticated, and then you have, it takes 2,000 years or 3,000 before another one is domesticated. And I probably shouldn't say the dog is domesticated, because at the time the dog became bonded to the human, domesticated animals lose about 20% of their brain. You know, take a goat. The goat herd is going to worry about the predators and stuff and make sure it gets fed, and they want the milk and the meat. So with the man and the dog, when the dog also lost 20% compared to the wolf, but the man lost 10%.
Is it like a use it or lose it, or what, you know, or is it just that life kind of shifted and then we just didn't use certain parts of the brain that they would have if they were still prowling around the wild?
Well, there's an argument going on about that has about 15 sides.
Oh, okay.
But it's fairly clear that generally, in the first place, the brain is the most energy-consuming part of the body. It consumes if you really set and work, it consumes as much as if you went out and you were doing a fast walk.
Right.
In terms of calories. It also is at the end of a very fragile spinal cord. Don't want it to get any bigger. You can only put so much bone around it because it gets heavy. If there's a mutation and something drops out of the brain,
mm-hmm.
so the animal doesn't have it, one of two things will happen. Either the animal won't do well, or the animal will do fine and will then do, you know, its offspring. It'll pretty soon take over the ecology.
Yes, it's almost like an argument for just kind of being in the middle of the road, right? The extremes on either end are almost parallel in different ways.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, John, this kind of touches upon a question that one of our, you know, we had the Early Bird Book Club contest, and these readers won a copy of your book, and Edward was one of the winners, and he says that it seems that a major piece of evidence for the dog-human symbiosis that you propose is loss of brain mass by both species some 12,000 years ago, but I kept wondering, is it possible that an equal or greater number of neurons got packed into a smaller cranium? Perhaps the evolutionary step was not only towards a smaller skull, but involved greater packing efficiency of the neurons?
I think it violates Occam's razor.
Oh.
The law of parsimony, that is, it's an explanation you don't need.
Oh, I see.
I can certainly follow the logic of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no particular reason. I mean, we know the other happens. So why reach out for some totally new thing
mm-hmm.
When we know we can get where we're going with the old model?
Well, he also talks about, you know, he said that you referred numerous times to the plasticity of the canid genome. He wasn't sure if that was an empirical inference based on the highly variable phenotypes exhibited by the hundreds of breeds of dog, or whether there's something truly distinctive about the dog's DNA at the cellular level. You know, is it possible or even likely that other species might exhibit a similar range of phenotypes if subjected to the sort of vigorous directed evolution that man has undertaken with dogs?
There are two sides to that argument, but the interesting thing is that he's touched on the argument.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That it probably happens both ways, and could happen either way. I'm the idea of the brain rearranging itself. Most of the argument goes on having to do other parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
The brain rearranging itself, certainly over time it does, but being more efficient, mm-hmm. I don't think you just don't find that kind of variability in efficiency in the animal world in terms of packing.
Well, you know, John, I was thinking, and I know we've kept you so long, but I wanted to ask you, and then I have one other question from another reader, but I wanted to ask you, when you finished the book, what was the most distinctive thing that you learned or most surprising thing? And then what do you hope that readers or dog owners understand from reading the book?
That biology may be complex, but it's also a frontier. And that, I mean, I'm not a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just an anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I can catch on to this, and I can do this research, and I can write this, and I had it vetted by scientists, and they only found one mistake. It's I've never liked the idea that only scientists could do science.
Yeah.
But in any event, this wasn't science in the sense that I did experiments, because, mm-hmm. I mean, in all sciences, one doesn't. Sciences tend to evolve mm-hmm. from people who make observations.
Mm-hmm.
And then people who figure out how to the observation. I made an observation.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't test it except in the minor way of, like, interviewing somebody about the veins on that dog's nose.
Right. Well, I think you kind of captured what an enigma it kind of is, this relationship we have. And the title, Wolf in the Parlor, I think even nowadays, people still have a hard time either believing that the dog is totally domesticated or, you know, efficiently domesticated enough that we don't just release them to some farmland to fend for themselves when we're tired of their company, because, you know, people who are educated enough know that the dog really would have a hard time without human help.
Yeah, the dog actually dies.
Right, and that some people have such a hard time with that concept. They either believe in a sort of Disney-like way that the dog is basically wild and would revert back to some behavior and just know how to survive, or they totally humanize the dog and kind of forget that it really is a wolf in the parlor. In many ways, it is not that far removed from its ancestors.
And you know, I think the thing that impresses me the most about the evolution of the brain of the animal and the behavior, mm-hmm. My poodle mm-hmm. could, if he wanted to, mm-hmm. and he could do this even before I knew it, mm-hmm. he could tear my arm off. I mean, he's not a wolf. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't do it as efficiently as a wolf, but it wouldn't take two of them to kill me. And we have, he's almost a wolf, mm-hmm. but some sort of buffer
yeah.
has grown in there. And I suspect when you see dogs go mad that they lose that buffer. But I mean, people talk about the closeness of the wolf and the dog. And there have been people who try to tame wolves.
Yeah.
But you know, would you actually put one in a bedroom with your baby?
No, that's exactly right. I think the point being that we need to have a healthy respect when we share our lives with these animals. We need to have a healthy respect and understanding of where they've come from, and at least try to reach out to them on a level that doesn't involve only human understanding, but understanding what their actual essential natures are about.
Well, they have, because of their history, mm-hmm. they are in a certain sense related to us. And I'm not an animal rights activist.
Oh, okay.
At all.
Uh-huh.
But I do think that an animal that's this close to us, that we have to give it special respect. Mm-hmm. If not for the animal, for ourselves.
Yeah.
I think that the reason that we don't want to look at them is that we do see ourselves in them, and we don't like that.
Okay, what do you think we see in them that is like ourselves?
We see the powerful sex drive that we deny. We see the hunger. We see the sadness, and it just messes us up emotionally because we can't keep up with it emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Its emotional circuits are bigger than ours. So what happens is, and I'm sure this has happened to every dog owner, this is not unusual at all. I got sick a little while back, and I was sick for a while, and Sam was the nurse. He was there all the time. You know, he would get me things.
Huh?
He wants to be of service,
mm-hmm.
and he would cuddle up to me, and you know something? I feel better when he cuddled up to me.
Right.
And this is a very difficult thing for a high testosterone male to admit.
Right. And do you feel that you have to define it, or is it just enough that that is the reality?
Unfortunately, I have to define it.
Uh-huh.
That's my nature. Mm-hmm. That has something to do with maleness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women tend to be able, with obvious exceptions, to let things be, you know. And mm-hmm. particularly, I mean, I have been trained since I was 10 to think in abstractions. You know, while I'm a writer, that proceeds in abstract ways, and particularly the way I do it, and that's true of many men, and the men who are too emotional don't do well in the workplace.
And John, I just want to go back just for my own self. When you said about dogs, the sadness that we clue into, I found that really fascinating. Can you talk a little more about what is that you perceive in a dog in terms of sadness?
If you promise a dog, if you make the move, and syntax.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make a move to play with them, I mean, this is as good for a dog as getting drunk is.
Yes, absolutely right.
Okay, and then you walk away from him. You know, his tail goes down, mm-hmm. his ears mm-hmm. go down.
Mm-hmm.
He'll probably lay down on the floor and put his paws together and put his chin on his paws.
Yeah.
Although, you know, while I said that, they normally react to our emotions.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, not that they don't have emotions, but if they feel we have a need, they feel they have a responsibility.
And you're right. In some ways, it's like a mirror of sometimes humans being petty and not being very generous. And the dog's willingness to just be in that moment and be ready for anything, I find moving.
Well, that's the big attraction of a dog. It's your pal.